Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, across the pond, the USA post-war geopolitical analysis. We hear from author Stephen Kinzo, who wrote a book called The Brothers and lives in New York, the brothers being Alan Dulles, who was the first director of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who at the same time was Secretary of State. So they both at the same time, one brother controlled the secret state and the other one controlled the State Department. Then it's Chris Mulligan, who's a publisher. He's based in Waterville, Oregon, on the West Coast, just north of California. And his father was a military intelligence officer. He has spent much of his time publishing information about who really runs the world. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre. On Jamaica Street, if you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Stephen Kinzer. I'm a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. I'm a columnist for the Boston Globe, a former New York Times foreign correspondent, and I'm the author of The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War.
So what was their secret world war? It sounds a grand title, Stephen.
John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles were two of the most powerful figures of the 20th century, but they have escaped historical judgment in a large measure. So this was the only time in American history that brothers, siblings, were responsible for the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State during most of the 1950s, when the United States was involved relentlessly in beginning its CIA-sponsored campaign of destabilizing and overthrowing governments around the world. His younger brother, Alan Dulles, was head of the CIA during the same period. So it's the only time that we've had such a confluence of family power that had so much impact around the world.
What were they doing during World War II?
The Dulles brothers came from a background of privilege, and both became partners in the super powerful Wall Street law firm called Sullivan and Cromwell. But when the war broke out, they took different paths. John Foster Dulles, the elder brother, who had always been more interested in law anyway, became the senior partner of Sullivan and Cromwell, and the highest paid lawyer in the United States. He also advised the German government and German municipalities and corporations in raising funds in the United States during the 1930s. He raised more money from American investors for corporations and others that helped to build Nazi power in Germany than any other broker or lawyer. And during the Second World War, he maintained his position at Sullivan and Cromwell and also established himself as a kind of Republican wise man on foreign policy. Alan Dulles was doing something quite different. He left the law firm at the beginning of World War II and joined the newly formed Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which was the predecessor of the CIA, the first American Secret Service. During the Second World War, he was the station chief in Bern, in the neutral Switzerland, and from there managed espionage operations that had reached throughout much of Europe. So he was already beginning on the path that would lead him some years later to become head of the CIA.
So Alan would have probably had touch with all sorts of people who would be halfway somewhere between the United States and the Nazi government, because Switzerland was a very important point for the Nazis. For example, they would have been all the way through the war certainly after Stalingrad in 1943, when they realised they were going to lose, that actually Switzerland was the perfect place for to squirrel away their resources. So is there any real evidence that Allen had contacts with Nazis there?
There's no doubt that particularly as the war proceeded and came toward an end, Allen Dulles began to understand that the Nazis were not going to be the enemies forever. And he took a couple of steps, including one very dramatic one, that seemed quite positive at the time, but that are later seen as having set off the kind of suspicions that spiraled into the Cold War. So as the war was coming to an end in May of 1945, Allen Dulles began negotiations with a Nazi colonel named Wolf, who had been one of the commanders of the SS and responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people during the war. What he wanted Wolf to do was to surrender his troops, which he knew he was going to have to do anyway, to the Americans, rather than wait and surrender them to a unified command that would also include the Red Army. So at the time, this was thought of as having shortened the war, although it turned out it only shortened the war in Italy by 5 days. The big difference was that Stalin saw this, I think quite correctly, as a way that the Americans were trying to freeze the Soviets out of Europe after the war ended. And many people now point back to that episode called Operation Sunrise as a moment when Allen Dulles helped set the Cold War in motion.
So what was this Operation Sunrise? How did it operate, and was it effective?
It was a negotiated settlement between Allen Dulles and this SS commander who had become the commander of Nazi forces in Italy. And on May 2nd, 1945, Allen Dulles brokered the surrender of those troops to an American command. Now, that set off jubilation in the army, but it turned out that the war ended anyway in Europe just 5 days later. Wolf was also protected from war crimes prosecution by the patronage of Allen Dulles. And as I said, the main long-term impact of that operation seems to have been that Stalin suddenly became much more suspicious of American motives and began to realize that even before the war ended, the Americans were trying to achieve their dominance in a post-war period, even if that meant cooperating with the Nazis instead of with their supposed military partners, the Soviets.
Now, to what extent, and there's been lots of there's something called Operation Paperclip, various other people have looked into this over the years. To what extent did the U.S. intelligence, Allen Dulles specifically in this case, embrace much of the Nazi high command? Because it did seem that the Cold War had started almost as soon as the Second World War had finished.
The key moment came when the head of the OSS, William Donovan, asked President Roosevelt for permission to hire and forgive senior spies and intelligence officers who had worked for the Nazis. Roosevelt refused to do this, but he died soon afterward. And we then began a project in which senior Nazi officers who had worked in intelligence work were brought to work for the United States. The most prominent of these was Reinhard Gehlen, who was the senior Nazi intelligence officer during the Second World War. At the end of the war, he made a deal with Americans, including Allen Dulles, under which he turned over his espionage network to the United States for a hefty sum. And later on, during the period of American occupation of West Germany, he was installed as the chief of West Germany's new intelligence service. So you had a guy that went essentially from being the chief of intelligence for the Nazi army to then making a deal with the United States to avoid punishment and indeed make a lot of money by turning over his spy service to the Americans. And then finally ends up as the intelligence chief of New West Germany under American occupation.
You talk about the influence of Alan and John, one on the inside, one on the outside of US foreign policy. What about the role of this organisation, the Council on Foreign Relations? Because they really represented the business interests, the financial interests that the US had in foreign policy. So it is interesting to see that some of the foreign policy of the US may have been shaped by business people simply wanting to use parts of the world for mining, exploring and controlling resources.
Right now, the Council on Foreign Relations is just another think tank in New York, but you're right, it has a fascinating history. So the Council on Foreign Relations was brought into existence after World War I. It started in the early 1920s. At that time, the U.S. State Department was actually quite small. There were few professional diplomats who really engaged themselves in following particular parts of the world. Meanwhile, U.S. business interests had truly become global, and American corporations were invested in all kinds of resource extraction and marketing projects all over the world. It became very important for these people that American foreign policy be set in accordance with the needs of multinational corporations. In order to influence this process, they didn't go into the State Department because, first of all, these were people who were very rich and they were corporate titans. They would not take diplomatic jobs. But also, there wasn't space for them in the foreign policy establishment. That wasn't what people did in those days. So they began to get together and write their own memos for the State Department, and many of those State Department officials, including secretaries of state, came from that same little social group. So they were very grateful to get these nice messages. Hundreds of these poured out of the Council on Foreign Relations during the 1920s and 30s, all reflecting the business interests of large American corporations and suggesting ways that American foreign policy should be shaped in order to promote those interests. In the absence of any other major source of foreign policy expertise and obedient to the inclinations of people in the State Department. Anyway, those memos, and by extension the people who wrote them, became the central force or a central force in shaping the foreign policy of the United States. And that set a pattern that's continued up to this day.
I mean, looking at the current tour of Mike Pompeo going out around the world and trying, it seems, to gather support for his possible war of words with Iran, but made to even potentially turn hot. I wonder what you think the role of the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations is in that sort of campaign, and really who's in the driving seat? Because it does look, if you look at the CFR today, it looks as if they're incredibly well financed, whereas actually large parts of the US government, for example, recently had to shut down completely for a while.
The think tank business in the United States is quite corrupt. You often have so-called independent experts who are connected to one think tank or another write articles explaining why it's a good idea to do a certain thing in a certain part of the world, and later you come to discover that these think tanks are actually being sponsored by interests inside the United States or directly or indirectly by foreign powers. As for the role of the State Department now, it's certainly not functioning as a diplomatic institution the way that it was intended to. You mentioned the escalating conflict with Iran, and I think that's a fine example. There is certainly a place for coercive diplomacy. It is an old tradition and an old part of international relations. But in order to have coercive diplomacy, you have to have some diplomacy going on. You can have a carrot and stick policy, but you have to have some carrot. And we're not doing that. We are not offering any diplomatic off-ramp to Iran, as far as we know. So the policy that the State Department is now following under Mike Pompeo is simply to demand that the Islamic Republic of Iran effectively liquidate itself and kneel in front of American power until the demands become a little more realistic. I don't think there's any prospect of diplomatic negotiation, and that means that the State Department, which is normally charged with trying to find diplomatic approaches to world problems, is effectively frozen out, and military force and the threat of force become our main weapons.
You talked about the foundation of the CIA by Alan Dulles. Some also say that the CIA was behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So is it a monster? And is it in any way accountable, the CIA? And also, was it involved in the death of John F. Kennedy?
The CIA has had a tremendous transformation in the period since 9/11. It began as a espionage operation under Harry Truman. Then it was expanded under Eisenhower to become an instrument of regime change. And Eisenhower did use it to overthrow foreign governments and seek to overthrow others and to destabilize countries where he thought unfavorable political processes were underway. Now the CIA has gotten to be something completely different. It has it sponsors armies. It's a killing machine. It's everywhere in the world. It wages war. And the covert action side of the CIA has largely been overwhelmed by this completely new overlay that I don't think was ever imagined by the founders of the CIA back in 1947. As for the Kennedy assassination, I suppose you can spend all the time you want speculating on who was responsible for that. But I do think there's one thing you can observe. Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles were in office when Fidel Castro took over. Alan Dulles was head of the CIA when we launched the Bay of Pigs invasion, and when the United States oversaw efforts to try to assassinate Fidel Castro. So when you look at the various theses or theories about the Kennedy assassination, they all have one thing in common, and that is they all go back to Cuba. So if you think it was the mafia that killed Kennedy, well, it was because the mafia lost their privileges in Cuba and Kennedy wouldn't fight to get it back. If you think it was the CIA and the security forces in the United States, well, it was because they were furious that Kennedy allowed Castro to escape and would not wage war against him. If you think it was Castro, it was retaliation for Kennedy's attempts to kill him. If you think it was the anti-Castro Cubans, it also goes back to Cuba. So the Dulles brothers, and particularly Alan Dulles, was part of the obsession with Cuba that in some way definitely plays into the Kennedy assassination.
But surely, I mean, certainly, I don't know if you can corroborate this, but I'd heard that John F. Kennedy actually swore that he would smash the CIA into pieces, and that obviously is not going to be Alan Dulles' favorite chap, is he?
After the Bay of Pigs invasion, Alan Dulles was fired as head of the CIA by President Kennedy. Later on, after the Kennedy assassination, Alan Dulles was made a member of the Warren Commission that investigated the Kennedy assassination. We now know that President Johnson, who named him to the Warren Commission, gave him a particular assignment. Johnson was one of the few people who knew that the CIA had been trying to kill Castro. He didn't want the Warren Commission to find this out, because once it understood that the United States, and particularly Kennedy, was trying to kill Castro, that could open up a whole new line of investigation in the assassination probe, which Johnson believed needed to be brought to a quick end. So he told Alan Dulles that his job on the commission was to make sure that the commission never found out about those assassination plots. And Alan Dulles fulfilled that role. Whether he had other motivations, nobody's managed to prove, but there's certainly out there plenty for the fevered mind.
I mean, you've painted an incredible picture of these two brothers, Stephen. What do you think, would today look different if they hadn't done what they'd done? I mean, to what extent have they shaped the modern world?
I think the Dulles brothers really did have a quite profound impact. One of the ways you can measure it is that they came out of a background of privilege. They came out of a class that believed that the interests of the United States were identical to the interests of giant American corporations. That was the world that they lived in, and those were the corporations they served for their whole professional lives. So when they moved from the service of those corporations as lawyers into the service of the United States government, they didn't change their perspective. They shaped American foreign policy in a very aggressive way. They were not able to understand the difference between third world nationalism and threats of communism, and set the United States off on a regime change era from which we still have not emerged.
Okay, Stephen, that's brilliant.
I'm going to have to leave it
there. That's brilliant. No, finished.
Outside.
That's lovely. Thanks ever so much.
That's great.
Cheers, Steve.
Okay, well, thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Stephen Kinzer, author of The Brothers, about the Dulles brothers, who lives in New York. And now some music from Consolidated, America Number One.
IBM and ITT and AT. DuPont, Dow, 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 DuPont, D Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Chris Milligan. I'm a publisher of Trine Day Books. We've been doing it almost 20 years. And I basically started doing this because of my father. He was a intelligence operative. He got involved as an 18-year-old kid as an exchange student to the University of Shanghai. Started working with the State Department. And then in 1939, he was supposed to go to school in Switzerland, graduate school. Well, that didn't happen. He ended up at the Library of Congress in D.C. Started working with COI, which is Coordinator of Information, which was William Donovan's first organization. And they made him told him to become an expert on the Philippines. And then he moved to OSS. Office of Strategic Services, and then while he was in the basement of the Library of Congress working for OSS, he got drafted, and OSS said, "Fine, we're gonna put you into the U.S. military. We're gonna put you into military intelligence. You're still gonna be working for OSS, and we're gonna send you to put you on MacArthur's staff, General Douglas MacArthur, because we do not trust General MacArthur and his top aide, Colonel Willoughby." And then he started working in psychological warfare during World War II. Also, then he went through a couple of alphas after the war and ended up in CIA. His last overt job was branch chief, head of all of East Asia analysis office. Then he started to go covert in the early 50s. And then after a trip where we were told as children he was going to be writing a book about the church in Southeast Asia, he went to the Far East, met with a gentleman by the name of Colonel Edwin Lansdale, and soon left the agency. He told me he left it soft in 57, left it hard in 59, and then he started talking to me in 69. I didn't quite understand what he was saying. He told me, he said, "They're out to opiate your whole generation." And then he took me into... he asked me first, he says, "What do you think of the Vietnam War?" And I gave him a flip teenage answer. I says, "Well, you have some hand grenades and you in a bag, and you go throw them in the rice paddies and win it." Guys were in white hats. And he said we had to have a talk. And day before my 20th birthday, he took me into a room with, this was 1969, with Professor D.F. Fleming from Vanderbilt. And told me all about his intelligence career, which had never been mentioned. He first started off the conversation. He says, "The Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it." I'm thinking he's talking about the mafia. And then he says, "And communism's all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game." At that point in time, I thought my daddy was nuts. But done some research since then, and he knew what he was talking about.
So, Chris, you saying there, hinting anyway, that the same secret societies might be behind organisations in the West and China. And yet, actually, the opposite is happening right now, isn't it? There's some massive kind of trade war apparently brewing, which could actually threaten both the Chinese, the US economy, and even the world economy. So if the same organisations are behind both sides, how can that be to anyone's advantage?
Well, because the end game of the secret societies is to, quote-unquote, rule the world through China. Okay, well, to do that, they have to destroy the United States of America. And Trump's doing a pretty good job in putting China much more in the driver's seat. I mean, the secret societies, they don't give a fig about the United States of America. All they've been using the United States of America for is to kill the Indians and take their land. You know, at its core, America is about ruling from the bottom up. Well, obviously, the secret societies would rather rule from the top down. And so that's, I mean, you had Skull and Bones. George H.W. Bush was the, actually, our second trade representative there. He went to Canton. And while he was going in Canton, his brother Prescott Bush Jr., also a member of the Order of Skull and Bones, went to Shanghai and started handing out the money to build all the factories. So it's they've been using a lot of Britain as a cat's paw, too.
You mentioned Bill Donovan. He's a quite interesting character from World War II. Not a lot of people have heard much about him, but he then went on to be one of the people that helped form the CIA in the first place. And he was also very much involved in covert operations during and throughout the war. What do you think were the most important things to take home about Donovan? And why should people, you know, actually check him out and find out what he was all about?
Well, he basically helped start the secret, you know, the intelligence services here in the United States. He was a good friend of Stevenson, the British MI6 guy. And, you know, I mean, he basically has to do with the history of the intelligence services here.
Wild Bill Donovan, I think they called him. He was also very much involved with the Brits in an operation called Operation James Bond, which was revealed in the 1990s in a book called Op JB. But also, you hinting there about the CIA being quite powerful. We've now got Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State, and one does get the impression that actually Trump is kind of going along with what Pompeo is doing, but Pompeo is trying to run the foreign policy along with John Bolton without much Congress or Trump input. Do you think that's true, and how's he getting on?
Well, I'm not a fan of Trump and Pompeo and what they're doing, and you know, living here in the United States is quite interesting. We've got a huge psychological warfare operation going on to get people into camps and, you know, not liking the people in other camps. There's an obvious big effort to help to create a civil war, create huge civil disturbances here in the United States.
So what is it, when you're talking about psychological operations, what's the nuts and bolts of that, and why is it important to the military nowadays?
Well, it's not just, you know, I mean, yeah, it's military, but it's also being used, again, by the secret societal operation. I mean, here's how the secret societies, quote-unquote, control the world. It's a leviathan of three levels. The top level is mining metal and money, okay? And it kind of makes sense. If you control the mining, where the metal comes from, that the money is supposed to be based on, you'd be in a good position. Then you have a central area where they do use war a lot, and that's drugs, guns, and oil, okay? And, you know, we look at Skull and Bones. We look at Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, the Mathesons. You know, opium became the largest commodity on the planet in the 1830s and has never left it. It creates huge, big slush funds, which allows them to control other industries. And then you have oil. In 1855, a gentleman from Skull and Bones, Dr. Benjamin Silliman Jr., made gasoline and paraffin for the very first time out of petroleum, out of rock oil. And then these secret societies have proceeded to
monopolize things around oil. The only reason we go to the oil store is because they own it. There is many other ways of creating energy, but it's about control. And then where this Leviathan meets the road, it's media. They have to control the media so they can control the dialogue. They can control the narrative. And then you have music. I mean, movies/music. They've got to control the culture or it'll bite them. And then you have quote-unquote magic, their ability to hoodwink us and their preponderance on using mass trauma rituals to keep us in line. At the end of the day, the Kennedy assassination was a ritual called the killing of the king. 9/11 was a mass ritual. Okay, you smash the archetypes and then you bring them back up the way that you want to. And like in the psychological warfare, it's like abortion. Okay, the powers that be don't really give a fig about abortion. Okay, but it is a gut issue. And they can use it to get people on opposite sides because they'd much rather have the population fighting each other about things than actually looking at how we're all getting, excuse my language, screwed.
Now, you're a publisher too in the Western U.S. Can you just give us an idea of a couple of books over the last couple of years you've published you're particularly proud of?
Oh, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, Dr. Mary's Monkey, The Inheritance, The Money Mafia, Tavistock Institute, Shadow Masters, Radical Peace, Lieber 420, books about marijuana. Marijuana shouldn't, you know. The only reason we have the prohibitions is so that plants can be sometimes sold more in gold in the black market. And prohibitions never work. When we had the prohibition here on alcohol, we ended up getting 12-year-old drunks, okay, because the guy behind the counter doesn't care how old you are, just if you can put a nickel on the thing. But they prohibitions have nothing to do with our health, our community, or our children. They have to do in place with keeping a black market in place, which allows these secret societies, again, to create huge, big slush funds. Because, you know, if you had two sugar companies, and you don't, there's really one sugar trust out there, okay? But if you had two of them and one of them was bringing in cocaine and the other one wasn't, who's going to last? We live in a ridiculous situation. And, yeah, I'm a publisher, but, it's just very, very hard to, we don't get any mention in the newspapers. We don't, get any mention on television. All we can do is to talk about them on the Internet and some of the
Yeah, that seems to be the object, is to get the real culture off of the mass media completely and drive it onto the Internet. It's almost like herding it onto the Internet, which then is very easy to monitor, control, and, of course, at some point, shut down. But look, there's a couple of books you've done, which I'd like you to just talk about, which you didn't mention there. One is one on the Franklin cover-up.
Oh, yes.
Can you just tell us why is that so important? Because, I mean, I think maybe in the UK with our child sex abuse inquiry, there's quite a few people involved in that inquiry, even working on it, that don't even know about this cover-up in the US.
Oh, right. And, well, I did a book called Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape. Because when we did the Franklin cover-up, and we did that, about 15 years ago, we were dealing with kids and, 8 to 15, and now we're dealing with kids in their diapers, okay? And it's criminal, and we find it prevalent within secret societies. We find it prevalent within some of the intelligence.
So what's the what's the purpose of this? Is it just a...
The purpose of it is control. For one thing, you end up... pedophilia, a lot of times, is multi-generational, okay? And so are secret societies. And if you're looking to control something multi-generational, it's one of the control mechanisms. And it creates an amazing amount of chaos.
You've mentioned these secret societies quite a bit. The most obvious one in the US is the Masons. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you know about them? Because I think it's quite fair to say that quite a few people are members of the Freemasons, but they don't actually know what's going on at the apex of the organization.
Right. I mean, a secret society, no matter where they are, they're always the same, whether you're talking in Africa, the Orient, or in the Occident. And you generally have a ball of wax or a pyramid. You have a lot of people on the outside, or in Masonic circles they call them porch brethren. They're good for favors, but they really don't know what's going on. And then you have an administrative cadre, because at any time in any organization there are the people that turn the lights off and on. And then you have a core group. In the core group, they're always all related. They're all cousins, okay? And like Skull and Bones is built around the Cabot family. You're based in Bristol. I think you've heard about the Cabots now and then. And with a big subset of the Whitney family. And most of the people in Masonic circles have no idea of what is going on. They can be, anytime you're a member of a pyramidal organization and somebody above you is supposed to tell you what to do, it can be used and abused. And, a secret society is a thing, just like anything. And it can be used for good or ill. It depends on what people do with it.
I think the Freemasons really started in a time of where there was very little tolerance of views, certainly here in Britain.
The Freemasons, it basically grew out of the Knights Templar. And if you look at Skull and Bones, Skull and Bones believes they're the Knights Templar. You look at their logo, that logo is a woodcut. That comes way before Skull and Bones was formed, and it was always around the Knights Templar. Matter of fact, there's still a Knights Templar lodge in Canada that still uses it. Yeah. Again, secret societies, generally in Freemason, where you see the most quote-unquote dirty stuff is in the 33rd degree.
Another book is called Critical Mass by a guy called Carter Heydrich. Now, this was published, I think, around the turn of the century, but it was buried for a long time. But it's a very important work, isn't it?
It shows how Borman started doing negotiations with Alan Dulles, and then you have Operation Sunrise, where Alan Dulles took the surrender of the German intelligence the day before the official German surrender. And they worked out a deal where they would trade some of their radioactive material and the triggering device and sent that to the United States. And then that triggering device was used in the early atomic bombs and along with some of the material.
It's very few people seem to realise that that Germany even had a nuclear weapons program. I mean, is there any real evidence for that?
Oh yeah, there's a whole bunch of evidence. Most recently turned up, like you say, that book came out actually two times before I picked it up again. And one reason that the author wanted to do it was because there became a whole bunch of more evidence about the German. Treatment of nuclear material to make it into radioactive fissional material.
Because this is what I find so fascinating about publishing, is by getting a book like that out, you'll find, before they die, quite a lot of people that know stuff about what happened in Nazi Germany will say, hang on a minute, I thought no one knew about this. and they can come to him and give him even more information, maybe even some of it disinformation. I just want your quick take, Chris, finally, on what's going on with the Iran and Israel, because a lot of people are looking at this and saying, gosh, Pompeo is really going for it this time. I wonder if you think it's actually a conflict that Pompeo can get going and the Israelis.
Well, knock on wood, I hope not. I pray not. We don't need to see any more war. And Yeah, I don't trust. I mean, there's some very interesting books out about Trump and Israel and the Third Temple and blah, blah, blah. And all these people, you know, again, Jerusalem's on the 33rd degree parallel. And you go back to the Balfour decision or declaration and all of this, and you have, you know, very interesting people in setting up Israel. And they obviously have some sort of quote-unquote mystical agenda. And then we have Trump supporting heavily the Saudis, which, again, then gets you into the Sunni-Shia split. And, I mean, I don't find Trump's foreign policy to be very intelligent and just kind of bombastic and following the money that he gets. You have Netanyahu's one of the hats, and you find that the hats are very prevalent in Russia working with Putin too.
Have you got any one particular, you think, historical book, not necessarily one you've published, Chris, that you think people should, it will really give them a bit of a take on some of the hidden history?
I've got a couple. One of them, this is not one I publish at all, but it's, oh, goodness gracious me, it's written by Sterling Seagrave. There's a version that comes out of Verso. It's called Gold Warriors. And I find that very, very interesting. Anybody that's ever read that book, myself included, your jaw just drops. Very, very good book. Most of his books were Book of the Month Club and New York Times bestsellers until he wrote that one. He had to publish it himself, and then he got so many death threats, he moved to Europe.
Okay, so what's the title of that again?
It's titled Gold Warriors. Gold Warriors. And there's one on Verso printed there in Britain. And then also another book I strongly recommend is called Generations, A History of America's Future. And it gets into the dynamics of generational cohorts, because that's one of the things that the secret societies plays. They really try and play generational warfare. And that's one of the reasons for one of the first things Skull and Bones did here was to take over education, because, they like to get people fighting each other.
Chris, what's a website? Where can people find your stuff?
Trineday, TRINEDAY.com.
And what does that mean? Why did you choose that title?
I was looking to do, my first thought was to do one called Good Day Press, and that was already taken. And I like dictionary and encyclopedias, and I was reading through the dictionary one day, and I came across the word trine, and it meant auspicious. And I said, well, that's kind of like good. And there's a double day, why couldn't there be a trine day? And then I'm a musician, and I like double entendre, and trying day kind of sounds like a trying day, and going to work can be a trying day. And
okay,
so
Chris,
that's where it came from.
Thanks very much. I think we have to get you on again at some point and talk to you about your music and your musical influences. But anyway, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. God bless.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Stephen Kinzer, author of The Brothers, and Triney Day publisher, Chris Mulligan. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Josh Chewers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8pm, inshallah. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.